Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Acclaimed author and scholar Martin Bidney writes poetry books that are dialogues. In Shakespeare, Sonnet replies to the 154 sonnets of William Shakespeare. He converses in Shakespearean sonnets with the 154 that the bisexual bard himself wrote in the 1590s about his boyfriend and girlfriend. In Shakespeare's 1609 book of 154 sonnets, you'll notice the welcoming, inclusive bisexual sensibility of the poem's narrator. He gets involved in three love triangles. First, a woman and two men. Next, a woman and two men. And finally, a triangle of three men. The emotional range is vast, the implications unending. There's no book that you can read that has more vital and empathetic LGBTQ plus interest and observations. Martin Bidney, Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Language at Binghamton University, upstate New York, taught there for 35 years. His wide-ranging fascination of revelatory writing stems from patterns of epiphany, where Martin pioneered a method of analysis he has since applied to over 20 authors. In his first 23 years of requirement, he has published 61 books of original and translated poetry, often including both in what he calls verse-translation interviews, with poets he has read in Polish, German, Russian, and French. A pleasure to welcome Martin Bidney, author of the captivating Shakespeare. Sonnet replies to the 154 sonnets of William Shakespeare. Martin, welcome to the program. It is a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Rick.
So much to talk about. This is such a fascinating book that you've written, the whole concept. The audio book is excellent. We'll get into all that during the course of the conversation. So how did people in Shakespeare's England respond to his unconventional bisexual book? And didn't he face any censorship during that time?
Well, he did as soon as he died. That is, he died in, about 1609? A little later than that, a few years after. But it was still before 1620. And in 1640 came along John Benson, whom I've learned about from scholars. This John Benson is not especially remembered today, and a good thing, too, because he took exception to Shakespeare's habit of addressing love poetry to men, and he tried to change as many as he could of the addressees into women instead. And that was the only readily accessible edition of Shakespeare that was available to people for the next, until 1780, 1640 to 1780. That's 140 years of censorship. And then in 1780, the wonderful and renowned Shakespeare scholar Edmund Malone published the book as it was meant to be read, because that's how Shakespeare wrote it, and Benson's memory was relegated to oblivion. So that's a bit of background for what happened. It sounds very contemporary, doesn't it? It sounds like issues that are being quarreled over today. So if there ever was one, I think from the point of view of sexual attitudes, a very relevant book for today's readers and listeners.
Somebody will
Go ahead.
I was going to say, somebody will be listening and go, what, Shakespeare was what? And they'll start marching on libraries as soon as the opportunity presents itself. It does sound like something out of contemporary times. How does the Shakespearean project of redefining gender relate to the Renaissance visual art? How did all that tie in together?
Oh, well, it's the we start in sonnet number one with a gender bending a comparison. Shall I refer you to now with to sonnet one?
Yes, please do.
I'd love to read it. From fairest creatures we desire increase, that thereby beauty's rose might never die. But as the riper should by time decease, his tender air might bear his memory. All these his indicates we're talking about a man, and he is called Beauty's Rose. That's a very, for thousands of years, male poets have used the rose as the ultimate symbol of femininity. So there is a questioning, a crossing of traditional delineation or definition borders with respect to genders. But thou, contracted to thine own bright eyes, feed'st thy light's flame with self-substantial fuel. You spend your time looking in the mirror instead of dating women. Making a famine where abundance lies, thyself thy foe, to thy sweet self too cruel. Thou that art now the world's fresh ornament, and only herald to the gaudy spring. You are the fresh ornament of the decoration of the world, and the only person who can be considered an appropriate MC and manager and introducer of the floral pageant worldwide of flowery spring. You play that role, and what do you do with it? Within thine own bud buriest thy content and tender churl. Tender? Well, maybe you're talking about love, but it's all love for yourself. Makes waste in a niggarding that is in miserly activity. Pity the world, or else this glutton be, to eat the world's dew by the grave and thee. Suppose I do now my reply so you get a hint of how these conversations work. Okay?
Yes, that will really lay the groundwork for the concept that you've developed that really excels in this book. Go ahead if you would, please.
A beauty rose? A man. Remarkable. Another man is telling him that he had best beget, lest love might die with full assent unrealized. A penury, that's a poverty, though cloaked in seeming riches. If self-prized, you nothing sowed, lived unproductively, regardless of the offspring dreamed, despised as barren death's own narrow home you'd be. Who doesn't wish to give, but shyly keeps the miser what is in him to bestow, in unawakened enervation sleeps, that will not let the eye or others grow. For love must lend, remain neglectful of the giving wisdom, and you'll never love.
I wish we would have had you as an English teacher, as a literature teacher. You bring it alive. In fact, you've talked about that you view a poem as an acting script, and you bring it to life. And there's a audiobook available of the book we're talking about as well. We'll give you all that information as we go through the interview here today. I want to ask you one question. As you were preparing for this concept, I mean, you're there talking to Shakespeare. How do you prepare for something like that? It's you, it's Martin, and it's Shakespeare. How do you prepare for that? And you really, we follow along like we're actually listening to the two of you in conversation. How do you bring that to life? What kind of research mindset do you have for this?
Well, I've had an unusual life. I was interested in total dedication to music before I ever cared that much about poetry. And what brings Shakespeare alive to me as somebody I want to talk to is the powerful music. It just grabs a hold of me, and I think, hey, I want to write an answer to that. That's how I felt 154 times.
And it shows in the book. The book's available wherever books are sold. Martin's website, by the way, martinbidney.com, BIDNEY. Information there on this book and all of the books that that Martin has written, and we've got a link for that on our website. Sonnets are...
Let me just correct that. It's martinbidney.org, not com.
Oh, .org. Yes. I'm sorry. I have that there. .org. Very simple. martinbidney.org, BIDNEY.org. Thank you for correcting me on that. And the correct link is on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Sonnets are very interesting. When sonnets are taught in schools, what approaches would be most helpful, most beneficial in teaching sonnets?
Teaching sonnets. Oh, well, my most emphatic recommendation is this. Read and have students read the entire Shakespeare collection. I don't think that's done much in the United States. I only got just a few carefully selected sonnets, very famous ones like, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate." It's beautiful. It's in 5 beat. La 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 la. And 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. Very charming. It's written, by the way, to Shakespeare's boyfriend. And you never learn that. You won't. There are very few high school teachers who will point that out because they may very well not know it. Perhaps they've never read the whole book through. Read the whole book through. And the reason why? Big reason. Because it's so contemporary, it's more like something out of present-day media. It's very much like a TV series or a psychological novel, or maybe a psychological novel set as a TV series, because there are these three love triangles that Will get, he calls himself Will in this book. He gets involved in them, and each one is a first-class drama with a very great sort of dramatic crisis in it, but we don't solve the problems. We just go on to the next because it's a kind of diary. It's really very predictive of modern free-flowing narratives that do not observe the conventions.
Could this book actually stimulate students, do you think, to write their own personal sonnets, to get them that involved that they really want to get involved and to write these?
Well, it did that to me. Why can't it?
Well,
do
yes,
it to
us? Yes.
Yeah. I don't recommend anybody do anything that I haven't tested out myself. By the way, you asked about what should we say, hedging of gender boundaries, and how that relates to other Renaissance art. And I have observed in one of my replies, I'll just tell you, rather than reading the whole poem, that both Leonardo and Michelangelo do the same gender bending, cliche breaking, boundary crossing, gendered portrayal that Shakespeare uses. And if we are going to be critical of that or censor it, as John Benson did, what kind of a visual renaissance are we going to have? Listen, for example, to what Leonardo does. Remember, he painted the Mona Lisa,
yes.
But not everybody is aware that he painted not just one Mona Lisa, although people are aware that he painted or part painted copies of it. But he gives the same face to Saint Anne as he gives to Lisa. And here's the interesting part. He gives the same face to St. John the Baptist, and then he gives the same face to the wine god Bacchus, who are most emphatically male. So it doesn't matter to Leonardo, really, whether you're a man or a woman or how society defines you. What's most important about you, as I'm going to show, says Leonardo in my most notable pictures and paintings, I'm going to show you that what really matters is that Mona Lisa face. That I can't forget. And that embodies what I care about most. And now we'll just do a similar number on Michelangelo. Let's see here what I say. Michelangelo's ultra-muscular men in the Sistine Chapel art have a hefty physique that carries over into the Sibyls, oracular female revelators revered by the Romans. Very hefty-looking women. It's almost as if he had modeled them on male physique and then made a few necessary changes, which are not great alterations. So a bisexual view of human nature is common to Michelangelo and Leonardo. It's interesting that I put them together like that, not just because of their greatness, because also that they are suspected of being left-handed, and I am too.
And I am as well, if we're going to throw that into the equation here as well.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
Our guest is Martin Bidney, B-I-D-N-E-Y, website martinbidney.org. How might this book, do you think, relate to the way we read Shakespeare's plays? How beneficial will this be? I would think this would open some doors and some curiosity that maybe hasn't been there before.
Well, it occurred to me last night that the first thing that comes to mind in trying to answer a question of that kind is a love dialogue. Somebody had to point this out to me. I hadn't noticed it. Where Romeo and Juliet exchange one-liners till they have enough of them, 14, to add up to a perfect Shakespearean sonnet. right there in the middle of the play. It's not labeled, and neither of the lovers remarks on what they have made, but we notice it, do we not? And then the bipolar ups and downs of extreme emotional joy and distress, and the moments of privilege, prolonged perplexity in Hamlet, relate to similar presentations in the sonnet. Nobody is really, I think, in moods more bipolar than Shakespeare. He reaches the height of heights and then the darkness of the deep and everything in between. It's a very entertaining book to read. People don't suspect it. They think it's going to be a tough job to get students to read it because of the archaic language. But I read a duo to you, an exchange between me and yes. Will. I don't think you found it hard to understand. I'll bet you found it very simple to grasp. I would like to make one suggestion, though, to teachers of Shakespeare. You do have to know how to say the sonnets. What's important in a Shakespeare sonnet, as everywhere in his plays, is that marvelous five-beat line, and one, and two, and three, and four, and five. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis better in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. La 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 la, la 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 la. The five beats. But if you turn to something like sonnet number 31 and you just open it up, it occurred to me that if you read that the way a modern person would read it, it sounds awful, or at least pretty mediocre. I'll do that right now, and I'll show you.
Okay.
Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead. And there reigns love and all love's loving parts, and all those friends which I thought buried. That sounds like a newspaper article. To me, it doesn't sound like a poem. What I do is I have edited the whole book so as to indicate when a syllable is pronounced and when it isn't pronounced. And the beat is the key, but modern people who don't customarily read five-beat word songs may not have this paradigm in their minds and hearts yet. If you do, or if you don't, you can follow my guidance in my edited version, where I always indicate by printing it out whether an ED at the end of a word is to be pronounced, or if it isn't, I write apostrophe D. And so now here, that same stanza edited in the way that Shakespeare would have spoken it aloud. Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead. And there reigns love, and all love's loving parts, and all those friends which I thought buried.
Night and day, there is a world of difference there hanging on that, and I wanted you to go more. There's really, you need to go to Martin's website, sample all of his work there, and order this book, Shakespeare, Sonnet Replies to the 154 Sonnets of William Shakespeare. And the website is martinbidney, BIDNEY.org. Why do you think Shakespeare gives the name Will to his narrator?
Oh, that's a fun question. He's playfully teasing us. That's the answer. I'll show you what I mean. I think this is be a fun dialogue to share with you. It's number 136. People don't realize, you know, we get a lot of talk in school about the inscrutability of Shakespeare. After all, he created characters. And if you quote a quote from Shakespeare, like adversity, what is it that's discretion? Discretion is the better part of valor. That can mean a dozen different things. It depends on what kind of a character is expressing it. And that's why people are very hesitant to ascribe opinions to Shakespeare on any subject, because he always talks through masks, which are his characters. And he doesn't seem to care what you think about what he says. What matters is what the characters say. And even in this poem, this book of poems, the sonnets, 154 of them, that's a work of imagining. And I'd rather not even talk about Shakespeare speaking it, because I'd rather say the Shakespeare narrator, and then I'm on safer ground, and I'm remembering that the poetry is a subspecies of fiction. Latin fingo meant I imagine, and fiction is an imagining. So, Will, oh yes, dialogue 136. This is really fun. A lot of people who think of Shakespeare as a hiding presence behind the characters will have to admit nonetheless that in this playful poem, he comes close, maybe closer, I'm not the first to suggest this, to presenting his real true self, because he makes endless puns and jokes on his own name, Will, as if to say, hey, folks, this is fiction, this is poetry, this is imagining, but this is also me. This is the real me. Listen to this. If thy soul check thee that I come so near, swear to thy blind soul that I was thy will. And will, thy soul knows, is admitted there. Thus far for love, my love suit sweet fulfill. Will fulfill the treasure of thy love. I fill it full with wills, and my will won. In things of great receipt, with ease we prove. Among a number, one is reckoned none. Then in the number, let me pass untold. Though in thy stores account I one must be, for nothing hold me. Consider me to be nothing, just ones. Well, what is that? So it please thee, if it please you, to hold that nothing me, a something sweet to thee. Make but my name thy love, and love that still, keep loving my name, and then thou lovest me, for my name is Will. Isn't that fun?
It is fun.
Now you'll see how a student can be expected to treat any one of these poems as a launch pad, because this one certainly was to me. I'd like to read you my reply.
Please.
Let these two wills be one. That one be Will. Then will he always have his will, you see? United, namely, they might coo and bill. That's a standard way to describe lovers, like cooing and billing as birds. Did you know what it is to bill? A bird, birds clack their beaks together. That's the way they kiss. United, namely, they might coo and bill, but for Bill is Will, right? Bill and William, same name,
yes.
And willing also she. For thought and rhyme and homonym agree in wanton ways that William's mind may thrill, and rivalries that riled him recently with euphony bemusedly can still. So wiser wit will sly suspicion kill. Let guile and guilt and crafty planning be by imbibition from a lethe rill of magic language, William wizardry undone. A lulling, pacifying pill can with an awesome calmness grant goodwill.
Our guest on the program is Martin Bidney. That's B-I-D-N-E-Y. The book we're talking about, Shakespeare, Sonnet Replies to the 154 Sonnets of William Shakespeare, one of many books in Martin's repertoire, and you will find all of those on his website, martinbidney.org. This idea of carrying on dialogues with poems and poets, where did this idea come from, and where do you see this idea going? Because it's almost limitless, isn't it, in what you can do and the stories that you can tell?
Yes, and that's why I can't stop. I published since retiring at age 61. Exactly 61 books. That's right. And most of them are dialogues, and I dialogue with everybody. And in fact, I look in ancient Greece and Rome, where you can get the stress patterns on the computer if you don't read Latin all that fluently. I had 2 years of it in high school. That taught me a lot. But now I'm learning a whole lot more with the diagrams. I read the Latin poems with the diagram, with the pitch and the stress diagrams in mind. And there you learn that you don't have to always rhyme in the Shakespeare way, or rather, you don't have to rhythm in his way, and one and two and three and four and five. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? You don't have to do that. You could write in three-syllable units like la-la-la or la-la-la or la-la-la. These all have Greek names, and I've written a book of poems on each. Once they grab a hold of you, they don't let go. It's very beautiful. Let me just show you an example.
Sure.
There's something called the Fourth Asclepiatic, which has twos and threes mixed together in a most intricate, lovely pattern. One and two and a three and four. One and two and a three. Four and a five and six. One and two and a three and four. One and two and a three. Four and a five and six. That was almost a song, and I'll prove it. One and two and a three and four. One and two and a three. Four and a five and six. One and two and a three and four. One and two and a three and four and a five and six.
There's that music background coming up again and singing and making it come to life. That adds so much more, really enhances the story that you're telling and the presentation that you're making.
You may be glad then that I have written a dozen songs and I have sneaked them into my poetry books, usually as an appendix at the end. With the sheet music is there as well as the lyrics, so you can start singing me if you feel like it.
Well, that's good. That's another reason to go to Martin's website and get all this information and books and enjoy them on a number of different levels. Does Shakespeare treat men and women he loves in a similar way or differently? How does he handle that?
Well, a scholar figured did all the work to get the answer to that. He determined that while both men and women can be frenemies of the narrator in the sonnets, generally, male lovers get to hear more complimentary language in the course of the book than female ones do. And here's a point. Can you let me read you what might be regarded as the central poem for bisexual study of Shakespeare in this book?
Please.
That'll be Sonnet 20. It's very famous for precisely this reason. It's utterly astounding in some ways. He is talking to his boyfriend, as he does all throughout the first 39 poems of the book. It's poem 40 before a woman shows up, and then he finds out very fast from the culprit himself that his boyfriend has been romancing her for years already. But let's start now with Sonnet 22, because I do want to get that into any talk about Shakespeare the bisexual. He says, "A woman's face with nature's own hand painted, hast thou? The master mistress of my passion. A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change, as is false women's fashion." A little bit of misogyny here. He's not entirely up to date. an eye more bright than theirs, less false in rolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling. You can do all kinds of things, masculine and feminine, which steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. And for a woman, here's my favorite line, "For a woman wert thou first created." Nature was making a woman, and everything was going along fine until nature, as she wrought thee, as she was working on you, fell a-doting. What does that mean? Absent-minded, sleepy, short-term memory loss? And by addition, me of thee defeated, by adding one thing, to my purpose nothing. You were creating a woman and everything was going along fine, and then you added something, which frankly I wasn't terribly thrilled to see. But since I'm going to explain that now, or rather I'm going to let Shakespeare explain it. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. You, fella, are the ideal boyfriend because you're also a girlfriend and you appeal to women and as equally to men everywhere you go, and I have the benefit of loving you in both of your aspects.
So well done. The book is a must read. It gives you Shakespeare in a whole new light, an enjoyable light through Martin Bidney's perspective. What's a good way to make the experience of Will's sonnets even livelier? I mean, you've exhibited some of those during the course of the conversation today. What's a good way to make those experiences even livelier, to get hooked young people on what's there, the way you did as you were studying this?
Read it all aloud and pay attention to the rhythm, and then get interested in rhythm by doing it, and then explore other rhythms. I've made myself into a rhythm speleologist or archaeologist, or I study threatened poetic life forms. I study stanza forms used in ancient Greece and Rome, which are entirely out of fashion today. And I have written a book called Bliss in Triple Rhythm, showing 9 different ways in which combinations of 2 and 3 syllable structure units can be used as the Greeks and Romans did. And then I give what is it, 100 or 200? I can't remember. It's a big, fat book. Plenty of examples of poems written by me in all of these measures. None of them are extinct so long as I'm alive.
Martin Bidney, our guest, and the time is going by so quickly. What other literary form could be given this added vitality in dialogue that you do? How else can this be used? Because I think you're onto something here. I've not talked to somebody who's created their own genre of literature like you have, and we're seeing firsthand how effective it is. It makes it really lively. It makes it contemporary. What other forms could use this approach?
Well, I think I could recommend most from the deepest experience the form that I call the verse translation interview. What you do is you find a poem that you love or a book of poems that you love, and you translate it. And for every poem you translate, you write a reply often in the form. I like to do it in the form that the person I was translating has taught me. Now, if you want some versatility in doing this, suppose you want to translate something, as I recently did, from Latin, and my Latin wasn't quite good enough to handle it. I wanted to translate the poem Tristia, which means sorrows, by Ovid, which he wrote in the wilds of Moldavia or Moldava, where he was sentenced to relegation. It wasn't technically exile, by Emperor Augustus Caesar because of supposedly some lapses in morality that appear in some of his verses. Ovid thought this amazingly unfair, and he wrote an entire epic in protest against it, but it's also filled with lyrics and the riches of mythology such as only an Ovid could know them. And what did I do? I wanted to translate it, but I didn't have the Latin for it. So here's the trick that I use. I'll go looking for translations which are of the highest quality of art, done by people who speak languages that I can read. I can read very nicely Russian, German, and French. And so in this case, I found an Ovid published in 1893 by the Russian poet Afanasy Fet, and he wrote gloriously helpful footnotes, and he wrote it in the most magnificent Russian that you could imagine. So I translated all of these hundreds of lines from Ovid fresh from the Russian.
It's just amazing what you've done, what the career that you've had has spanned. And I've got 30 seconds left here at the end. You're at 61 books, I think you said now. There's a reason for that. What do you think is next for you? What are you going to do next?
Oh, well, I actually, when I got my fourfold nerve disease of double cubital tunnel and double carpal tunnel, I thought I was going to be disabled for the rest of my life. But I got it cured with stretches and no surgery. And once having been cured, I thought it was like a miracle from heaven. And even before I was cured, I was allowed to do an hour a day at my new ergonomic keyboard, and I said to myself, I'm tired of this ban on violin playing. The therapist said it would complicate the cure. I wasn't allowed to play violin for 6 weeks. I'm going to produce music by translating my favorite poets from some other language. I picked Russian. I was a Russian major. I took an MA in Russian, and I translated a poem called Love from the Russian, keeping all the beauty of the form so far as I could do so in English. And then I gave it to a poetry instructor at Binghamton University the next day to look at. And she said, do a dozen and I'll print them in the journal that I edit.
This has been such a enlightening conversation. I've loved the time that we've had together with our guest, Martin Bidney, B-I-D-N-E-Y. His website is martinbidney.org. Links on our website will take you there, and you'll be able to not only get information on this book, Shakespeare, Sonnet Replies to the 154 Sonnets of William Shakespeare, but all of the books as well, and some background, a number of podcasts that Martin has recorded making his poems come alive. It's all on his website, martinbidney.org. And my thanks to Galley Brokers, leveraging expertise to drive success, making your literary ambitions into reality. I thank them for arranging our conversation today. Martin, the time has gone by way too quickly. I'd love to make this the first of several conversations. So much more to talk about. Thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Rick.
Excellent job. Really enjoyed this. The book's available, of course, wherever books are sold. Check out his website, martinbidney.org. You're listening to This Week in America and more on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.